With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the 2023 Grape Crush Report shows increases in tonnage and average prices, and advancements in the aquaculture industry. But where does the U.S. still need work? We'll have more on that. But our top story today, a look at how the Agriculture Department and its various mission areas are reflected in the President's Fiscal Year 2025 Federal Budget Proposal. Here's Rod Bain.
Rural energy production and clean energy, the American Climate Corps, an increased nutrition safety net, more global food aid. Those are among the USDA-connected aspects of President Biden's proposed fiscal year 2025 federal budget released Monday. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack provided additional comment on the proposed budget, saying it makes targeted investments in particular areas. Among those, modernizing our nation's wildland workforce, increased scientific and research tools and technologies, expanding rural economic loan capacity, and building additional partnerships and collaborative efforts in areas such as climate mitigation. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
USDA's new Ag Trade Update has a mixed bag of news. Gary Crawford has the details.
We now have the complete ag trade numbers for the first 4 months of this 2024 fiscal year, October through January, and it's a mixed bag. First, on the downside, U.S. ag exports totaling $63 billion.
Down 9% from the same time in fiscal year 23.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says month by month, ag export values have been dipping further and further below year-ago levels. In October, 6% below. November and December, 7%.
And January, year-to-date, is down 9%.
So not going in the right direction. But for some products, Kenner says prospects are improving. Corn, for example. Corn export values have been running 30% or so below year-ago levels within this new report.
Corn exports were $3.8 billion. No percentage change from the previous year.
So corn export values are holding their own. Plus,
the volume of corn exports are up 35%.
So a definite improvement for corn in this report. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Several women were among the foundation layers of various aspects of the U.S. Forest Service long before their ascension into leadership roles in the agency. Here's Rod Bain once again.
If one looks at the U.S. Forest Service and women's contributions to the agency and our nation's forest, a historical starting point for them may be dates of leadership, such as the hiring of the first district ranger in 1979. Yet Forest Service historian Rachel Klein notes there have been significant contributions by women that go even beyond the formation of the agency in 1905, going as far back as when the Forest Service's predecessor, the Bureau of Forestry, was under Interior Department oversight in the 19th century.
Even prior to that, we have a lot of women who are engaging in environmental advocacy as early as 1850, at least in print.
The daughter of author James Fenimore Cooper wrote the journal-style book, Rural Hours, discussing environmental conservation around that time.
She predates notable work like those of Henry Thoreau or George Perkins Marsh, and especially Aldo Leopold being a century prior.
The century also features the Forest Reserve Act in 1891, leading to creation of such reserves in public domain, due in part by advocacy from women's groups.
See a lot of women advocating for the creation of forest reserves, for the creation of legislation that protects birds in particular.
Klein also points to significant contributions by women long before their establishment in official leadership roles.
What women did was they sought careers in forestry and conservation from different angles, if you will.
She elaborates.
A lot of women served in the Forest Service as advocates, foresters, rangers' wives, clerks, information and education specialists, scientific researchers, and lookouts.
Several women in the first half of Forest Service history also studied ecological and environmental sciences like botany.
What they're doing in these different roles is really pioneering and supporting the development of the agency's forest management infrastructure.
Among examples of such efforts, Julia Shin, a paid clerk in the Sierra Nevada National Forest.
She was so well respected respected for her administrative skills that rangers and supervisors throughout the region would often look to her for advice.
Forest Service librarian Helen Stockbridge grew a resource library over three decades of service.
And she created numerous bibliographies for district rangers to draw from. What she's doing is showing how women are creating the information database for the agency to draw from.
Women were also involved in education and public outreach aspects of the U.S. Forest Service during the early years.
Margaret March Mount, who served as the director of women's forestry in the 1940s, she was advocating for fire prevention long before Smokey ever did. She was fondly known as the ambassador of trees, who inspired children and women to plant millions of trees. And those forests can still be seen across the country today.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Those late winter and early spring storms may have damaged the trees in your yard. Here's how to evaluate damage and fix it. Gary Crawford has more.
Many areas of the country have had multiple ice storms this winter, snowstorms, and lots of tornadoes across the south. And in my area, a lot of days with high winds. So we've been hearing a lot of reports like this.
We've got power lines down.
Many of those lines down because trees and tree limbs fell on them. It has been a tough time for trees, so as we finally get into spring, what should we do about possible tree damage in our yards? One obvious thing.
First of all, we just need to stand back and look at the tree.
Without, you know, seeming odd about that. That's the easy part, though. Dennis Patton is Kansas State University Extension horticulturist.
And what we're looking for initially would be what I would call hangers or broken branches that are just barely hanging on. You know, a wind or something like that could easily knock those out of the tree and damage property or hurt you. So first of all, just assess the tree to make sure you don't have any of these potential falling branches.
Also, you may have already had limbs come down over the winter. We did at our house. Patton says you don't want to just leave those places, you know, where the limbs snapped like they are. Those edges need to be recut, and if you don't do that,
rotten decay is going to get in there, and that rot will follow down into that stem over time and just increase the decay. You also may get a lot of what we call sucker growth coming out of those areas too that are going to be very weak wooded. So in the next wind, those are going to be more likely to be damaged.
Some of this work, of course, you can do yourself if it's near the ground. But Patton says,
if it involves you getting more than one or two steps off the ground on a ladder, you need to call a professional to do the job. There are accidents every year where would-be do-gooders are trying to get up there and reach that broken limb, and they end up falling, getting hurt. Of course, you got power lines to deal with, all those type of things. So here again, if it's more than a couple steps off the ground, hire a professional.
Yeah, just keep in mind that insurance commercial, you know, where the homeowner's up there with a chainsaw cutting that big limb and right on the car.
Hence the reason why it's always better to hire a professional.
Yes.
They assume some of the liability then if a dumb accident like that would happen.
Now, hopefully the people you hire will know the basics of pruning these damaged limbs. For example,
always go back to the next lower branch, crotch angle, fork in the tree, junction, whatever term you want to call it. And then we make our clean cut there.
Why there?
That area there has the best ability in the tree to seal off, help heal that wound, and direct that growth to a positive location energy in the tree itself.
Oh, and Dennis Patton says there's no need for paints, sealants, anything like that on those cuts. The tree knows what to do. And Patton says doing a good job on that damaged tree
probably is going to help set that tree up for a longer life.
And less damage in the future, too. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, there are $15 million in the just-passed fiscal year 2024 USDA spending bill to help cattle producers equip their animals with electronic ID tags, a key to limiting disease outbreaks. Former head of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Todd Wilkinson, says the EID funds will go a long way toward improving cattle traceability and reducing the financial burden on producers.
So the fact that we have $15 million coming through the appropriation side is a major win.
And it's a win for limiting the possibly devastating impact on the cattle industry from a disease like foot and mouth.
If that comes into the United States, the current plan is to shut the entire country down from all cattle movement for a minimum of 72 72 hours, and it's probably going to go a lot longer than that.
Bud Wilkinson, a South Dakota cattle producer, says electronic tags speed up traceability reporting between states, thereby limiting those shutdowns in unaffected areas. And to those producers who don't want to bother with electronic tags,
all of us have to just think back to the BSE case and other situations. Look at our friends in the poultry business. Look at what pork is facing. If we don't think an animal disease is going to come into this country, as porous as our borders are, and impact our producers, you're burying your head in the sand.
Wilkinson refutes concerns electronic tracking will divulge producer information publicly and argues without better traceability, industry losses to disease outbreaks won't be in the millions of dollars, but billions of dollars. In other livestock news, a look at the 2024 milk market with USDA economist Michael McConnell.
We're forecasting prices that are coming off of the recent lows that we saw in 2023 and increasing a bit. However, they're not quite as high as the highest prices we've seen in the past 3 years. Butter and non-fat dry milk, butter, not projecting prices to spike quite as high as all the past couple years, but still pretty strong seasonal movement in the butter price. And NDM, a steady increase in improvement from previous year. Cheese is the one dairy product we're actually expecting year over year prices to be lower. But again, we're expecting the price to come up a bit from the recent lows that we've seen in the past couple months. So with higher butter and NDM values, as well as broadly speaking, stronger cheese and whey, we're expecting class prices to be higher year over year as well. We expect the class four price to remain higher than the class three. The value of butter and NDM continue to be relatively higher than the historical standards compared to cheese and whey. We're projecting an all milk price to be $20.95 a pound in 2024. It's higher than what it was in 2023, but not necessarily as high as we saw 2 years ago in 2022.
In other livestock news, the National Pork Producers Council announced the induction of new officers and newly elected members to its board of directors. We're thrilled to welcome these accomplished individuals to NPPC's board of directors, says NPP CEO Brian Humphreys. The diverse backgrounds and proven track records will provide valuable perspectives and strategic insight as the pork industry navigates the challenges and opportunities ahead. Lori Stevermer of Easton, Minnesota was elected NPPC president. She's co-owner of Trails End Farm and has a rich history of advocating for the pork industry at local, state, and national levels. She previously served on the executive board of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. During her year as president-elect, she exemplified her leadership and unwavering commitment to the industry by testifying before Congress and representing the industry at international trade conferences. Dwayne Statler of Ohio was elected as president-elect. Rob Brenneman of Washington, Iowa is the new vice president. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The Department of Pesticide Regulation has announced a new position that will reportedly help advance efforts to transition to more sustainable pest management approaches. Michael Milligan will join DPR's executive leadership team as its first Sustainable Pest Management Assistant Director and Special Advisor. Milliken comes to DPR with a Bachelor of Arts in both Philosophy and Literature, and prior to DPR, he served as the IPM Program Administrator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. DPR notes that sustainable pest management is meant to build on the decades-long practice of IPM while incorporating the three sustainability pillars, which DPR defines as human health and social equity, environmental protections, and economic vitality. DPR Director Julie Henderson said Milliken brings creative, innovative, and forward-thinking IPM experience to the department's efforts to accelerate a system-wide transition to sustainable pest management. A recent survey by the American Seed Trade Association indicated a growing interest in cover crops, with additional acreage to be planted over the next 5 years. The expected increase in cover cropping will come as a result of USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities projects. Participants of the program were surveyed, and 18 projects that shared acreage estimates resulted in additional 10.5 million acres of cover crops throughout their 3 or 5 year duration. The survey results indicate a conservative estimate suggesting the actual acreage could be higher. Cover crops offer economic and environmental benefits by reducing erosion, enhancing soil health, and aiding pest control. Of the 123 projects that were surveyed, the practice of cover cropping is planned to be implemented in 88 projects across 82 commodities. Federal funding to support the projects is nearly $2.4 billion. The deadline to apply for the Conservation Stewardship Program from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service is coming up March 22nd. Assistant State Conservationist with NRCS, Brandon Bates, highlighted their relationship with USDA's Farm Service Agency in providing conservation resources to producers.
We work hand-in-hand with our sister agency, FSA, which is the holders of eligibility for a majority of USDA programs. So in most offices or service centers, FSA and NRCS are located in the same building. So it's necessarily regardless if they come in with us and we walk them across the hall and get them set up with FSA, but also it happens the other way around. Individuals come in with FSA inquiring about conservation programs, and of course they bring them over. So our process, of course, we work hand in hand with FSA. So the first off, we need to make sure that they have farm records established, and that's where FSA comes in at. And we call it making sure they're in the system. Once they're in the system, we're able to pull up their property on in their farm and tract numbers, but also look at developing the actual application and the contract. So that eligibility piece is very important, making sure that both the applicant and the land are both eligible for the program, or necessarily all USDA programs.
The California final grape crush report's been released for 2023, featuring increases in tonnage and average prices. The total grape crush in California was just under 3.9 million tons, a 6.2% increase from the year prior. Red wine varieties increased 3%, constituting the largest share of more than 1.9 million tons. White wine varieties totaled more than 1.7 million tons, an increase of 15.6% from 2022. Crush tons of raisin-type varieties decreased by 54% to just under 49,000 tons. The average price of all varieties in 2023 followed the upward trend of the past few years, increasing 11.2% to a little more than $1,036 a ton. Prices increased for both red and white wine grapes and decreased for raisin and table grape varieties. The Fertilizer Research and Education Program is evaluating how it can better support the work done by crop consultants and advisors across California. FREP will be hosting a series of focus group sessions to gather feedback and suggestions on irrigation and nutrient management. The first session will be held at the Fresno County Cooperative Extension on Thursday, March 21st. The second session is scheduled for March 22nd at the Kings County Cooperative Extension in Hanford. The third session will be held in Santa Maria at the Santa Barbara County Commissioner Office on Thursday, March 28th. Participants will be asked to provide feedback about their current use of informational products and services, gaps in available information, and how to improve delivery of information to facilitate learning and adoption of practices. More information about the focus groups is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
U.S. rice growers are seeing a growing demand for their products. Gary Crawford has more in today's This Land of Ours report.
U.S. rice growers seem to be the major exceptions in the current low-price commodity scenario. Crops like wheat, corn, and soybeans have been bringing lower prices and have still struggled in the export market. But USDA's Outlook Chairman Mark Jagodowski says generally U.S. rice is having a pretty good year.
Prices generally are strong. Global supplies are relatively tight. India's export controls on rice is helping to tighten up global rice supply situation, and that's helping to support prices worldwide.
Meanwhile, USDA has raised its rice export forecast and now says exports will top last season by 37%.
And we raised our season average rice market price this month by 40 cents per hundredweight, so currently at $18.80 per hundredweight.
Yes, that's a dollar less than last season, but of course still a very good price. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. The administration has announced major actions to enhance integrity and fairness in the food industry and in the banking industry. Gary Crawford has more in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation.
We've heard the president say that many times, including a couple of years ago when he created a competition council, a group of top administration officials with the mission of increasing the level of competition in many key industries. And then just a few days ago, President Biden and members of his competition council announced an escalation of that effort.
No matter how much money you make, no matter how rich or poor or middle class you are, you don't like being taken advantage of. That's why today I'm launching a new strike force on unfair and illegal pricing to crack down on companies who break the law while keeping prices high for American consumers.
To hold companies accountable when they engage in unfair and illegal practices that keep prices high.
An important next step in a fight against unfair and anti-competitive pricing.
Be it in the grocery store or at the pharmacy.
So this is very, very popular with farmers.
It's going to increase competition and put billions of dollars back in the pockets of American families.
That last voice belongs to Rohit Chopra. He heads up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and he says one of the first changes we consumers will see in this effort will be on our credit card bills.
We're finalizing this rule that will lower the typical late fee charged by big credit card issuers from $32 down to about $8 in most cases, an average savings of $220 per year for the more than 45 million people who are charged these fees.
Now let's go to see what's happening in the food and agricultural side of this. First on food labels, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says right now there's confusion about exactly what the phrase product of the U.S. means on a meat and poultry product label. The same with claims about how the animals were raised. But Vilsack says,
we're very close to publishing a final rule that aligns the product of the USA label with consumer understanding of what that claim means. We're working on label standards and verification guidance for claims such as animal-raised practices so that consumers can trust those labels.
Meanwhile, more on the competition front, the Packers and Stockyards Act, first passed way back in 1921, prohibits discrimination, deception, and retaliation in contracts and other dealings in meat and livestock buying and selling.
And this final rule will provide for a clear, more effective standard by which to govern all of this in the marketplace.
Agriculture Secretary Vilsack announced on a Zoom hookup with reporters a final rule under the Packers and Stockyards Act designed to help even the playing field for livestock producers in their contract dealings with large consolidated meat packers.
It's going to help producers receive protection against packers, swine contractors, and live poultry dealers who may be trying to terminate them on a pretext. For example, claiming that a poultry termination is on animal welfare grounds, or perhaps refusing to deal someone because they say their cattle quality is poor when it's not.
Vilsack later told a meeting of the President's Competition Council that the new rule, along with other steps the USDA is taking, will enhance market integrity and transparency and will help protect producers against unfair practices, to which President Biden asked,
what kind of a response you're getting from farmers?
Vilsack's answer?
Mr. President, they welcome these changes. For far too long, they felt that they were at the mercy of a relatively small number of integrators and processors. So to the extent that they now have more options to be able to process their cattle at local and independently owned processing facilities, some of which are farmer owned, to the extent that they know that they have a balanced playing field, that they understand better who they're doing business with, they understand that they have certain rights, that they can in fact seek a better deal. All of that, I think, is something that's been very much desired in the marketplace across all farm groups and across all associations. So this is very, very popular with farmers.
And Vilsack said USDA is working on a couple of other rules that will also boost competition in the livestock market, aligning with President Biden's view on that subject.
Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington.
A visit with rural electric cooperative representatives allows the Agriculture Secretary opportunity to announce new developments within USDA clean energy production and infrastructure programs. Rod Main reports.
A trio consisting of part of the Agriculture Department's portfolio of clean energy investment programs were the focus of announcements recently by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. His visits with members of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association began with news about picking up the pace of the Powering Affordable Clean Energy program.
We had tremendous response to the PACE program, 12 times the amount of available resources in applications. We accepted 41 invitations for additional information covering 22 states and 196 projects. For the first time, we're going to make a series of announcements. The first five applications submitted and approved for financing for a total of $139 million.
Projects benefiting cooperative members and disadvantaged and tribal communities
in Arizona, Colorado, Hawaii, and Nebraska, the recipients of this first wave of approvals. There will be more coming over the course of the next several months.
A second announcement was associated with the Empowering Rural America New Era program.
We're inviting the first group of co-ops back to move forward in this process with a full application.
A group of seven rural electric cooperative applicants
representing dozens of the distribution cooperatives in Colorado, Indiana, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Florida, and Texas to provide us additional information.
The secretary adds the goal is rolling out several application requests for New Era to make actual awards over the next 2 months. The total New Era program offers up to $9.7 billion.
Designed to challenge rural electric cooperatives to transition from a reliance on fossil fuel generated to a more balanced portfolio that includes renewable energy.
And USDA is encouraging clean energy project development through electric infrastructure loans and loan guarantees.
$2.2 billion that will be invested through our core electric programs in 21 states, putting resources in new infrastructure, in smart grid technology, and renewable energy systems.
Secretary Vilsack says this is among other clean energy funding opportunities in lieu of more applications for PACE and New Era support than resources available. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just want to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. For today's featured interview, we're talking about aquaculture. Here's the interview.
Hi, I'm Drew Winters. I'm the campaign manager for an organization called Stronger America Through Seafood. We're a coalition of industry partners across the seafood supply chain working in support of expanded U.S. aquaculture industry, especially offshore aquaculture in U.S. federal waters.
You were at the USDA Ag Outlook Forum that was held and went to the session on aquaculture. Can you tell me a little bit about what you heard there and what you thought about the conversation?
So we were really pleased that that conversation was happening at all. It was the first time that aquaculture was included in the Ag Outlook Forum, and increasingly aquaculture needs to be considered an important part of our U.S. food supply. Aquaculture is agriculture. The raising of animals is very similar to farming livestock. There's animal husbandry, there's animal health. We're growing healthy protein for food consumption, and it's a sustainable protein. So I heard a lot about the need for a resilient food system and including U.S. grown seafood in that resilient food system. And I heard a lot about the changes in aquaculture feed and the benefits for U.S. farming communities because of the inclusion of soybeans and other grains in fish food. That has really changed a lot over the last 20 years, the ingredients in fish food, and it's become much more crop-based. And so it presents a great market for agricultural interest in getting more involved in aquaculture.
The U.S. does not produce a lot of aquaculture. Where are we in production-wise, and how could we be doing better?
So the U.S. is actually really behind a lot of other countries. We're 17th, I believe, in aquaculture production. And the real key to expanding that is to move into U.S. federal waters. So the U.S. does have an aquaculture industry. Some of that is freshwater farming. Some of it is in coastal areas. Some of it is in land-based systems. But there are no farms in U.S. federal waters right now. The regulatory process is very complex, very time consuming. It is nearly impossible to get through the process. There are farmers who have been trying to establish operations in federal waters, finfish farms, for decades and have been unable to get through the process. So the real key to being able to expand our seafood supply through aquaculture is going to be able to do that in federal waters. And we really need federal legislation to help us get there. We need a clear authority to farm in federal waters, and we need a clear pathway through the regulatory process. And SAT, Stronger America Through Seafood, has been advocating for a bill called the Aqua Act in Congress that would do just that.
What about seafood consumption? Are we big consumers of seafood in the U.S.?
We are huge consumers of seafood in the U.S. I'll have to get the numbers on how much we consume, but the staggering statistic is how much seafood we import. So the U.S. is a net importer of food in general. That statistic came out for the first time recently, but the U.S. imports somewhere between 60 and 80% of our own seafood, depending on how you calculate it. And 50% of that is farm raised. So we actually produce very little of our own seafood, and we're getting a big chunk of it from overseas already. But seafood consumption in the U.S. is going up. It's steadily growing, and it will continue to grow, we believe, in the future. So there's a huge market for this and a huge demand, particularly for sustainable, healthy seafoods. And we can do that through aquaculture.
The challenge is making it more accessible, I guess, to farmers and those who want to get into the industry.
Correct. It is very difficult. It's very expensive to start a farm, and it's almost impossible to get through the regulatory process. So we do need clarity around the ability to do this, and we need a lead agency to help farmers through the process. And we need a focus on continuing to innovate in this space. There have been huge changes over the last 20 years that have really reduced the environmental footprint of aquaculture, everything from feeds to water quality to even how we treat fish health and fish disease with vaccines and probiotics versus antibiotics. So those kind of advances can really continue to improve. And, you know, U.S. is a great innovator, and we've exported a lot of our technology in the aquaculture space to other countries who have made it much easier to get farms in the water. We know we can do it here. We know we can do it well. And wouldn't it be great if we could control our own seafood supply, make sure we know where it's coming from, who's producing it, and that we are reducing our climate impacts. You know, aquaculture is one of the most sustainable forms of protein production. And that's something we should be thinking to as climate change impacts are increasing.
Yeah. And, you know, and I was going to ask you about that, the sustainability aspect of it. And especially with the USDA having such a big position, I guess, on sustainability within the last couple of years, and especially in this administration, they've been really pushing for the sustainable agriculture, increasing sustainable practices, really pushing the climate smart agenda. And so with that in mind, with the USDA, are you seeing more movement toward making aquaculture more accessible, or is it something that is still needing that push to get those wheels turning?
So I think both NOAA and the USDA have a strong commitment to offshore aquaculture. They recently came out with a national economic plan for aquaculture. Both the last administration and this administration have been supportive of offshore aquaculture. NOAA has been doing great work to establish aquaculture opportunity areas. And I think for a long time, USDA has been helping aquaculture farmers. But we still have that hurdle that we need to get over to make this viable. And that's really only going to happen, we believe, through federal legislation. They've made a lot of great strides through executive action and through agency leadership. But the real trick is going to be to get something through Congress to make this really viable.
We are talking with campaign manager for the organization Stronger America Through Seafood, Drew Winters, and we're talking about aquaculture in the U.S.
You mentioned needing a lead agency to really take charge of this. Who would that be, or which would that be, I guess?
You know, under our bill, we call for NOAA to be the lead agency on this, just because typically NOAA has engaged more in the marine space, and that's where this is happening. So I don't think there's any opposition to USDA potentially taking the lead on this. There are some bills out there that call for a USDA Office of Aquaculture. And, you know, the more support for aquaculture, the better. But as of right now, our bill does call for NOAA to be the lead agency. And I believe because of the national standards that they usually develop for the Magnuson-Stevens Act and the ability to do something similar under our bill for offshore aquaculture and that expertise in the marine space.
Right. You mentioned feed and how that gets other agricultural groups involved and it brings more of our agriculture industries together within this space. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, fish feed used to be primarily fish oil and you know, and wild fish inputs into fish feed. That has really changed a whole lot with the inclusion of novel products, which I guess are not so novel anymore. You know, soy has been going into fish feed for a long time, but rice, barley, wheat, those things all go into crops. So, you know, feed is developed very carefully to meet the nutritional needs of fish. And so as more research is done, you know, they're even looking at things like insects and algae and seaweed going into fish feed to reduce those wild fish inputs. So fish feed has gotten incredibly more sustainable. But U.S. soy is one of the major contributors to aquafeed across the world. And it's really important, and it's a great market opportunity for U.S. farmers as well to have their homegrown crops in fish feed. So it provides a whole new market for American farmers.
So if we're talking about or talking to consumers, how would you explain to them why you see this as important for them?
So, you know, seafood is an incredibly healthy source of protein. So from the perspective of health and the omega-3s in fish oil, it's really important. U.S. dietary guidelines call for Americans to eat far more seafood for a range of health benefits. We're not doing that yet, although seafood consumption has increased. So for a healthy lifestyle and a climate-smart source of protein, U.S. grown seafood is going to be really, really important. In addition to that, people want to know where their seafood comes from and that it's ethically grown and ethically sourced. And I think U.S. aquaculture provides a great opportunity to meet those needs.
Right. Is there any other key point that you want our listeners to know or anything that we've missed?
You know, we just think it's so important for more voices to come to the table to support a U.S. offshore aquaculture industry. We're just so pleased that the USDA is thinking more about U.S. aquaculture and how to expand it. We're really grateful for that. But, you know, most of all, we want to emphasize the changes really in aquaculture production and how that's become so much more sustainable. There continues to be misinformation out there about the sustainability and the environmental footprint of aquaculture. And it's so important to know the real story around how seafood is grown and how well it's grown and that it really doesn't have the environmental impacts of the past.
Yeah, and sometimes that misinformation is really hard to counter. Would this provide more accessibility to places where we're nowhere near an ocean?
Right. So I think that, you know, more locally grown seafood in U.S. waters provides the opportunity to get seafood to more places in the U.S. that are landlocked and you know, provide that source of healthy source of protein to people. I do think that, you know, having, you know, more seafood and as more people start to grow seafood, as more people start to enjoy seafood, that will become more prevalent on, you know, supermarket shelves.
Thank you again to Drew Winters, campaign manager for Stronger America Through Seafood. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.